Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reismandel, and I'm your host on today's program. We're going to talk about the future of music in the face of media consolidation, but the hope for reform. If you've been listening to Media Geek at all this year, you probably know that media ownership is back on the FCC's docket, and people from around the country and from many walks are telling the commission why it shouldn't allow more consolidation. On Monday, December 11th, the FCC held a public hearing on the issue in Nashville, Tennessee, where musicians, famous and unknown, turned out to tell the FCC how consolidation in the radio industry has hurt them and hurt American music. Jenny Toomey is one woman who testified. She sang and played guitar in the popular indie rock band Tsunami in the 1990s. Along with partner Kristen Thompson, she ran the independent music label Simple Machines from 1990 to 1998, learning firsthand how changes in the media industry were affecting musicians. Now Jenny is the executive director of the Future of Music Coalition. I talked with her on December 14th, the day after the coalition released a critical report on the state of music radio, and she's going to tell us more about that report and the findings. But first, she's going to tell us a little bit more about the Future of Music Coalition.
The Future of Music Coalition is a nonprofit organization that has been in existence since 2000. It was founded around the principle that, you know, we believed or understood that the entire landscape for musicians was changing because of the emerging digital marketplace, and that we were concerned that musicians, particularly independent musicians, were not within the discussions that were being held on their behalf. So this meant issues around how artists would get paid in the future, how music would be distributed in the future, who would control those pipelines, whether artists would want to use DRM. And we were also hoping to use the sort of sunlight that was coming through the internet on these emerging issues to sort of shine a spotlight backwards onto the existing business practices. So, you know, we would use the discussion of how artists would get paid in the future to look at some of the failures of, say, existing musicians' record contracts. But the original organization started when we wrote a manifesto, put it on the web, and realized we had thousands of people who agreed with us. And within about 6 months, we realized we needed to take a more formal role in the space, and we applied for 501c3 status and organized a major conference, and we've been here ever since. You know, we've long said, you know, when people talk about the impact that that false trading has had on musicians, we never like to discount that, because if it's hurting artists, then it's a real concern for us. That said, what we've always talked about is that, you know, we also need to have sort of a measured approach, and it's not simply about going after, you know, piracy, but also addressing contract reform for artists and our biggest issue, which is radio reform. In 1996, the FCC and Congress changed the rules which determined ownership limits on radio stations in the United States. Whereas before you could only own 40 stations nationally, that limit became, you really can't call it a limit because it became unlimited. So they went from saying you could only own 40 stations nationally to saying you could own an unlimited number. And in a period of about 6 years, Clear Channel went from owning that 40 stations that was the original limit to owning something that was almost as close, it was pretty close to 1,240 stations. This drastic consolidation of the radio moved programming away from sort of locally focused individual owners who owned these radio stations and moved it towards more of a national focus. And this meant that there were fewer radio stations that would actually take chances on individual artists, because artists were being tested in pools, sort of small groups of pools that would then be flown out to, you know, sort of all the subsidiary record labels. And so what we end up having is, you know, much fewer ramps for artists to get on the airwaves, much more national ramps as opposed to local ramps, and also the sort of concentrated control of the radio led to an exaggeration of the payola practices, which Elliot Spitzer, the Attorney General from New York City, was able to identify in his settlements with the major labels and the upcoming settlement with the radio companies. So the concentration of radio made it much, much harder for artists to connect with their fans and begin to develop a career.
Is radio still important for bands and musicians in terms of establishing themselves and broadening their audience?
I think personally, it's tremendously important. You know, it's a tremendous legitimizer for artists being played on their local radio stations. It is one of the few forms that really, really focuses locally. So, you know, if you're playing in a local symphony orchestra and there's not a local classical music station that can actually talk about the program that's coming down, of course, people won't know how to come and see that work. So I think it's tremendously important. There are a lot of people who talk about the way that the internet and webcasting and satellite radio and internet radio are stepping in and offering sort of much more diverse options for both music fans and for artists who are trying to connect with those music fans. And we love all those technologies. But just because we love them doesn't mean that we think we should let the FCC or the radio companies off the hook and say that they're just simply allowed to, you know, use robots to program a handful of songs on our very precious and incredibly valuable public airwaves. And the fact of the matter is, you know, it's wonderful if you've got an iPod and you're downloading great playlists. But it's expensive, and not everyone can afford that. And it seems a shame that we would just give up this tremendous resource, which is ubiquitous, it's public, it's free, and it's locally focused, and just let it fail. And I think, you know, the sad fact, and one of the things we tried to prove in our most recent study, is that not only did this underserve musicians, and not only did it underserve music fans or people who are concerned about local news or, you know, local community reporting, but it also has underserved the radio industry, who's lost, you know, listenership tremendously over the past 14 years. I think it's gone down 22%. So, you know, our feeling is that it doesn't benefit anyone to allow further consolidation, and that, you know, radio is tremendously vibrant. NPR has doubled its listenership in the past 5 years, and there's no reason why people wouldn't want to listen to well-programmed local music that actually served the diversity of the populations around the country if it were programmed for them.
Instead of radio that's programmed for local communities, what instead are we seeing in music radio?
Well, what you're seeing is the majority of the almost every market in the country is dominated by four radio station owners or fewer, and those station owners program largely in a range of between 8 and 15 formats. These formats overlap tremendously. So, you know, between supposedly distinct formats, you'll have as many as 24 out of the same 30 songs being played on them. And so what you see is you've lost the local connection between the public and the programmer, and then you've also lost the tremendous diversity, because, you know, 15 formats sounds like a lot if there isn't that tremendous overlap. But when you look at what's being played, you know, and when you know that the majority of what's being programmed is in these 8 formats, and you know that those formats don't include jazz, classical, Americana, folk, bluegrass, emerging independent rock, then you understand that we're missing, you know, some of the most vibrant forms of music in most markets, and that's a shame.
You are also a musician, in addition to being with the Future of Music Coalition as the executive director. What has been your personal experience with radio? Both, I guess, as a musician attempting to, you know, make a living at it, and as a listener?
Well, I've noticed a change. I mean, people wonder why we did this study. I mean, it's certainly not the most fun thing in the world. We certainly had a hard time getting journalists to cover it because, you know, we're talking about concentration of ownership and diversity indexes and concentrations that would raise questions at the Department of Justice, you know, is not as exciting as discussing, you know, Paris Hilton's, you know, activities, or so it seems, because, you know, certainly Paris gets a lot more coverage than media consolidation does. But the reason we actually took the time to do this is because as musicians, you know, we felt something had happened. You know, I remember when I went on my first tours, which were, you know, in 90, 91, 92, and you'd drive around the country and you'd go to different cities and the radio would sound different, you know. And also, you know, the strip malls would have different stores and there'd be different kinds of food. You know, you'd go to San Francisco and you'd know you'd be getting great coffee, or Seattle. You know, you knew you were going to get great Mexican food in Texas or in Tucson. And these were differences that you sort of really, really looked forward to, these sort of regional contributions that, you know, culinary and musical contributions that you got to see. And as we toured later, we began to realize, and really it did happen, you know, 95, 96, 97, you began to realize you heard the exact same songs no matter where you were. We began to have national hits. And I think people who are young don't realize that, you know, before we had MTV, you know, there weren't immediate national hits. You know, our country was too big to have them. You know, you'd go to other countries like England and they would be able to have, you know, nationally created hits where, you know, at the same moment all around the country people would be listening to the same song. But, and I'm not saying that, you know, songs didn't rise to a level where they were successful almost all around the country, but there were different, there was different genres of music that were emphasized in different parts of the country and different songs making that climb up towards the pinnacle of a national hit in different parts of the country. And everyone will talk about this. Tom Morello, who was on our phone call yesterday, talked about stations in Buffalo and other small cities that took a risk on Rage Against the Machine. REM talked a lot about being able to play on college radio in Athens, Georgia, and how that was their first step towards getting a national hit. And without those kinds of ramps, artists just don't have the same ability to break through and begin to develop a career.
And you're listening to an interview with Jenny Toomey from the Future of Music Coalition. We're talking about radio and industry consolidation and how it's affected musicians and American music in general. And this is Media Geek. My name is Paul Riesmandel. I'm your host. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog, a pretty frequently updated blog full of news and views in our media environment. I will admit, I took nearly a month hiatus. Didn't mean to. Combination of sickness and some sort of internet malaise, I suppose, kept me away. But I'm back and blogging, so do check it out at MediaGeek.net. You can find the radio program at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can download it, you can subscribe to the podcast, or now you can also just listen live right there in your browser. That's a new feature. If you just want to go there and listen without any downloads or any podcast subscriptions, just go to Radio.MediaGeek.net. Of course, if you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, Paul@MediaGeek.net. Now return to this interview with Jenny Toomey.
What sort of changes with regard to radio would the Future Music Coalition like to see?
Well, we have a 5-point plan that's actually articulated in our recommendations of the study. And I'm going to take a flying leap at remembering exactly what we said there. But one of the things was hold the line against future consolidation because, you know, right now the National Association of Broadcasters and some of the larger radio owners are advocating to raise the caps even further in the urban markets. So right now you can own 8 in every sort of largest radio market, and they would like that to be up as high as 12. So we would say hold the line against future consolidation. One of the things our study proves is that the overwhelming majority of the diversity of the radio that's being programmed, you know, sort of radio that's being programmed in other languages and all of those legacy formats that I talked about before, like jazz, classical, folk, bluegrass, as well as the emerging formats like independent rock or, you know, fusion, free jazz, these kinds of things, are almost, you know, overwhelmingly programmed by small broadcasters and non-commercial stations. So we encourage the FCC to support non-commercial radio, to expand those licenses, protect them. We also have talked about the possibility of not only holding the line against future consolidation, but maybe re-regulating. So, you know, in the case of the upcoming Clear Channel is attempting to sell off over 400 of its stations, it might be interesting to create either tax incentives to get those stations in the hands of individual owners or minority broadcasters, or to put some conditions on how they are how they're transferred. Furthermore, we want to make sure that in the upcoming digital radio transition, which is, without getting too complicated, basically radio is moving away from an analog format to a digital format, and the efficiencies that we get from moving to this digital format means that in the exact same space, on the radio dial where one radio station is now. We could conceivably have two or three radio stations, and right now the FCC has basically grandfathered that capacity to the existing license holders. So, you know, this of course means that if Clear Channel has 1,000 stations, then they theoretically have 3,000 stations. And our feeling is that it's wonderful if you would give that extra capacity to the non-commercial stations who are giving us all the diversity of the radio. But folks who have just been using their licenses to program in a tremendously commercial and homogenous way maybe shouldn't get that extra capacity, and that capacity should be given to individual owners or non-commercial owners. Or there should be some requirements put on those stations to ensure that they actually serve the local population and the diversity of that local population as well.
As a non-commercial broadcaster myself, I'm very glad to see that that's a strong plank in your platform.
Well, yep, that's what, you know, you should definitely read that section of the study because, you know, really, I mean, you guys are doing the heavy lifting. The NAB, you know, true to form, put out a press release before our study came out trying to discredit it. They did this the last time we put a study out as well. And one of their criticisms was that we weren't counting, you know, the incredible increase in Hispanic radio programming and Asian radio programming. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we don't deny that. It's actually in our statistics. But the fact of the matter is those are overwhelmingly either non-commercial or individual or smaller broadcasters who are broadcasting that diversity. So, you know, they can say we failed to mention it, but it certainly goes completely counter to their argument they should be allowed to consolidate further because the consolidators are not the ones that are programming this stuff that they're so proud of.
If I'm a music fan and I worry about the state of what I hear on the radio, and I'd like to hear more different types of music, more diversity, more independent artists, what can I do?
What can you do? Well, you can do a number of things. I mean, in the short term, you can support wonderful non-commercial radio stations if you have them around you. We have a couple good non-commercial radio stations. People can support radio stations that they like even more, that fit their specific interests even more on the web, because many of these are now building national audiences, and you see that with great stations like WFMU or KXP, or KCRW, who are, you know, not only webcasting, but also co-sponsoring concerts all around the country. And, you know, these are great radio stations to support and keep alive. At the same time, if you'd like to do something more political, right now the FCC is having sort of an open period of comments to discuss whether or not they would allow more consolidation, not just in radio, but also in other forms of media like newspapers and television stations. And it doesn't take too much time to raise your concerns and put your comments on the record. And you can simply do that by going to the FCC website, or if that's confusing, you can go to a website that's easier to remember, stopbigmedia.org. And they have an easy template. You can put your information in there and type in your feelings and make sure that the FCC hears what you feel. Finally, I was able to testify before the FCC in Nashville on Monday. And, you know, it was a tremendous honor. I was seated between George Jones and Porter Wagoner, and Naomi Judd was hovering around, and, you know, and there were all sorts of other wonderful legacy country musicians who were making the case against radio consolidation. And there will be two more of these hearings. They'll be announced on the FCC website, and if you sign up at Future of Music to get our newsletter, www.futureofmusic.org, just on the main page you can sign up, you'll always know when those hearings come. And when those hearings come, you can go out if they're anywhere near you, and you can wait in line and actually tell the FCC what you think. And it's tremendously inspiring. The hearing I went to on Monday began at 1 o'clock and didn't end until after 10:30 at night because, you know, and people were standing up and given 2 minutes each to tell what they thought, and hundreds of people told the FCC what they thought about consolidation.
So the people you heard in Nashville were generally suspicious about more radio consolidation and passionate about it?
I would say that from my memory, and I was not in the room for the entire day, but from my memory, I didn't hear one person support further radio consolidation. Now, this hearing isn't simply about radio. It was also about the radio, the newspaper and television cross-ownership ban and other issues that are before the FCC right now. And in those cases, sometimes there were people who were expressing the benefits of some forms of consolidation. But in the case of radio, I think the message was uniform, which was that, you know, the 1996 change was a bad one, and we don't want to go in that direction. We want to go right back into the opposite direction.
And I know it's difficult to answer this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Did you get a sense from the FCC commissioners, especially the Republican commissioners, on their reaction to what you had to say and what some of the other musicians had to say?
You know, I really have to praise the FCC commissioners for holding these localism hearings. When the previous chairman of the commission, Chairman Michael Powell, only had one localism hearing, and actually I think it was an ownership hearing, and it was in Richmond, and I was able to testify at that hearing as well. And one was not enough. It really wasn't enough. And when you see how time consuming and how exhausting it is to sit for, I mean, I guess they sat for like over 11 hours hearing testimony, I really have to hand it to them for doing that. Do I think that the commissioners, particularly the Republicans, heard what the public was saying with regards to radio? Yes, I do think that. I think I'll be very surprised if the FCC attempts to raise the local ownership caps on radio after what they've heard from the first two hearings.
So very much, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.
No problem. Thanks for wanting me to speak with you.
And that was Jenny Toomey from the Future of Music Coalition. You can learn more about the coalition at futureofmusic.org. You can learn more about Jenny at her website, Jenny Toomey, that's TOOMEY.com. And you are listening to Media Geek. In a few minutes we have left here, going to catch up on a little bit of news. Something that's sort of sitting in the not-so-far background, but waiting to lunge at us, is the proposed merger between AT&T and Bell South to create the largest telecommunications company in the United States, somewhat reclaiming the old AT&T of yore before the breakup. And on December 8th, the FCC's general counsel, Sam Fader, decided that Commissioner Robert McDowell can indeed vote on that merger. McDowell used to work for the Competitive Telecommunications Association, known as CompTel, which is one of a number of parties that have opposed the merger. They are the industry lobby for many of the small competing telephone companies that are often working against Bell South, AT&T, and the other large companies like Verizon. However, the general counsel of the FCC found, quote, the interest of the government in the employees' participation outweighs the concern that a reasonable person may question the integrity of the agency's programs and operations. And he was deciding that per the Code of Federal Regulations. Even though Fader himself noted in his ruling that he had consulted with the government ethics chief, Robert Cusick, who said he would not let McDowell participate. However, Cusick agreed that the FCC has a discretion in this case to decide what it wants to do, and that it could reasonably come out either way. Representative John Dingell, Democrat of Michigan, who will head the Energy and Commerce Committee next year, and Representative Edward Markey, Democrat of Michigan, the new chairman of the Telecommunications and Internet Subcommittee, however, want McDowell to abstain and think he does have a conflict of interest. Dingell has already said in public that he will want his committee to take more oversight over the entire matter of the AT&T and Bell South merger. And reports say that McDowell has been conducting meetings on Capitol Hill, still trying to decide whether or not he will willingly participate in the merger vote. The vote has already been postponed several times. It is not on the schedule for the commission's December 20th meeting. It's been postponed because Kevin Martin, the chairman of the FCC, does not yet have the necessary 3-2 to push through approval of the merger without any meaningful constraints. The Justice Department this year passed the approval with no constraints whatsoever. Many advocates of the public interest of the future of the internet wanting net neutrality are appalled at that decision, or hoping the FCC will put meaningful constraints on the merger, requiring the new AT&T Bell South to obey meaningful network neutrality requirements, to obey build-out requirements and other things to serve poor communities and to better serve the public as a whole. And if McDowell doesn't vote, it's a 2-2, two Republicans to two Democrats, giving the Democrats a far more sway over what happens. So we will be pursing the edge of our seats to see how the future of our telecommunications and our internet are affected by what goes on. Those five rascally FCC commissioners. And one other quick little note here, going into the world of amateur radio, something I don't cover so much here on Media Geek, but yet it's a form of independent media, a form of independent communications that has often been very important in our history. Coming forward specifically in the Hurricane Katrina disaster of last year, where ham radio, amateur radio operators provided very important and necessary communications in times of need. And on December 15th, as we go to air, the FCC adopted a report and order that ruling that it's getting rid of the Morse code requirements for obtaining a general class or amateur extra class amateur radio license and revising the operating privileges for technician class licenses. Now, what does that mean to us? It means that if you would want to start working in ham radio, you would no longer need to have to learn Morse code, which is something which is, you know, and many people believe is antiquated. Certainly, it's a holdover from the days of telegraphing and from the days when you could not yet transmit speech over radio waves, and is a very efficient way to communicate when perhaps atmospheric conditions or other conditions preclude you from being able to use speech or hear speech clearly over shortwave. But many people also view as a truly antiquated requirement, which serves as a barrier for new people getting into amateur radio. Many people think that amateur radio is a very aging hobby, where new people, especially young people, are no longer getting involved as a way to speak to people around the world, since the internet and other technologies often fill in its place. But amateur radio does work when the telephone lines go down and if you've got a generator that works when the electricity goes down. So maybe this is a move that can help rejuvenate amateur radio. I don't know. I'm sure the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League, which is, for all intents and purposes, the lobby and the national organization that advocates for amateur radio, will have something to say on the matter. I just thought it was an interesting little note. And the final note is I want to make sure everyone knows about the National Conference for Media Reform, January 12th through 14th in Memphis, Tennessee, sponsored and put on by Free Press. You can learn more about it at freepress.net. It looks to be another big shindig with a lot of famous folks. There'll certainly be at least a couple of Democrat FCC commissioners there, as well as Boots Riley from the coup. I've been to the first and the second of the National Conferences of Media Reform, which happened in 2003 and 2005. Reported live here on Media Geek for both of those. You can go back and look at the November 2003 and the May 2005 archives at radio.mediageek.net. If you want to hear those shows, Boots Riley was a performer along with Billy Bragg at the first one. Put on a great show. An amazing, amazing show, all organized and themed around freedom to communicate and opposing further media consolidation. So it may be something you want to go to, and right now I'm making my plans. So there's a good chance that Media Geek will be broadcasting live there from Memphis, Tennessee, January 12th through 14th. Go to freepress.net. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can be downloaded at radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. The program is also heard on 10 other community stations around North America. They are Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salina, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington, and Free Radio San Diego. Media Geek is free to air on your local community station as well. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also the address where you can send your comments about the program. Once again, that's Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.